Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Voters will get a say on lowering their property tax bills, but observers are putting a warning on several tax-related constitutional amendments.
You may want to consider what other taxes are going to be increased because you lower your property taxes. Chances are, if you save the money in one pocket, it's going to come out of the other.
Also this week, could there be any political backlash for a state agency head and GOP gubernatorial candidate over a lapse in background checks for concealed weapons license applications?
I'm not asking for him to resign. I think those are premature. But I do think a hearing is warranted. You know, in the House, we have a reputation of being the watchdog. Well, without a hearing, apparently we want to be the lapdog.
We'll also check out the positions of various Florida candidates for governor when it comes to higher and lower education. And we'll ask the timely question, what is news and when is that news fake? I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Recent polling shows there are four constitutional amendments poised for probable approval on Florida's November ballot. Three of those deal exclusively with the issue of taxation. But as Lynn Hatter reports, there's ongoing concern that determining tax policy through constitutional referenda isn't in the public's best interest.
Florida voters will likely give themselves an additional property tax break, but the November ballot's Amendment 1 comes with a catch.
You know, there's only 4.3 million homes that receive a homestead exemption in the state of Florida, but only half of those would qualify for this exemption. So really, only 50% of some of your homeowners are even going to benefit.
Craig and Mosteller represents the Florida Association of Counties, which is opposed to the measure. For one, it has the potential to further reduce tax bills to the tune of $645 million. That's $645 million less for local governments.
And they're going to have to consider what they can invest in and continue to improve efficiencies. But at the same time, I know that if I were voting for this, I would want everyone to get a piece of this. I certainly would think that if I'm voting for something to go into my constitution, it should be an amendment that everyone gets to benefit from. And that's not the case on this one.
Not every homeowner will see a benefit from the amendment should it be approved. For one, it's only for people living in their primary residences. Two, they're not exempt from school board taxes. And three,
it wouldn't apply even to all homeowners because your home has to be worth more than $125,000 because it's only an exemption for the tranche between $100,000 and $125,000 of value.
Robert Weissert is with the government spending watchdog group Florida Tax Watch. He calls the measure bad policy, describing it as a continuation of a tax shift that's led to overtaxing businesses and renters and undertaxing primary homeowners. And he argues any benefit the amendment would have should it pass will likely be negated through other ways.
Well, the biggest way that local governments make it up is by taxing non-homesteaded properties. It's by raising the general millage rate and putting that burden onto businesses. The other ways include user fees. So we see a lot of garbage collection fees, park fees, other kinds of direct user fees, and those can go up. There's a number of communities now that have considered local option sales taxes.
That leads directly to the ballot's Amendment 2, which Weissert says would cover more people, those who own commercial properties, second homes, and a growing segment of Florida's population. Renters. Amendment 2 would continue a 10% increase cap for these non-homestead properties.
The renters and the businesses are picking up much, much more of the property tax revenues than are homesteaded properties. Amendment 2 helps to not necessarily offset that balance. It doesn't put any more on homesteaders, but it doesn't make the imbalance even worse.
Still, there's the question of whether these policies and others belong in Florida's constitution. Both were placed on the ballot by the Florida legislature, and it's part of a longer-term trend that's concerning to Florida State University political scientist Carol Weissert. And if you're wondering about the last names, she's Robert Weissert's mother.
The legislature is slowly but surely deleting a lot of the local government's ability to raise taxes and to have that end. Taxpayers don't really want to pay more taxes, so I think the fiscal issue is an important one.
Which leads to the third tax-related amendment Florida voters will see come November. Florida lawmakers also want to make it harder for their future selves to raise taxes, requiring a supermajority vote in both chambers to do it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Len Hatter.
Florida's Agriculture and Consumer Services Commissioner says he wants to set the record straight about what happened to close to 300 background checks for guns, which were revoked due to an issue at his agency. Still, despite ongoing criticisms, could Adam Putnam face political fallout over the issue? Sasha Cordner has more.
A Tampa Bay Times investigation found the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services did not complete enhanced background checks for a year because of a login issue. That was contained within an Inspector General's report that looked at concealed weapons licenses, or CWL, applications submitted between February 2016 to March 2017. Commissioner Adam Putnam says background checks were still done on the thousands of CWL applications during that time period.
The 350,000 individuals had their names and fingerprints run through all three databases. 365 of them had non-criminal disqualifying information in their past that would prevent them from being eligible for a CWL. Those 365 sat on the desk of a negligent employee. We have since corrected that and revoked the licenses of 291 of the 365.
Throughout his telling of what happened, Putnam has been on the defensive. He's repeatedly blamed that one employee who is included in the IG report. She's since been fired.
The negligent and deceptive employee failed to follow up on the results of non-criminal background check disqualifying information on those CWLs.
While several media reports indicate they're not sure who initiated the IG investigation, Putnam insists he did.
We took immediate action and implemented the Inspector General investigation.
Still, some critics have questioned why, even though this occurred from 2016 to 2017, why it's only coming out now. Overall, Putnam says his agency has now put safeguards in place in the application review process.
As a result of this IG investigation and the processes that we have implemented, this should not ever happen again. And I will continue to hold all of my people accountable across the entire department for all of the responsibilities we have, including licensing.
There are differing opinions on what happened and what the next step moving forward should be. To those with public safety concerns, Putnam has maintained having a permit does not necessarily mean someone can buy a gun, since they go through similar checks for the purchase. The National Rifle Association's Marion Hammer agrees, recently defending Putnam to her membership. Governor Rick Scott has called what happened, quote, disturbing and concerning, adding, quote, we all expect our government to do their job. Some Republicans have openly criticized Putnam, including his main primary gubernatorial opponent, Ron DeSantis, while some Democrats, including gubernatorial candidates, have called on Putnam to resign. Others are calling for an expanded investigation first.
I'm not asking for him to resign. I think those are premature. But I do think a hearing is warranted. You know, in the House, we have a reputation of being the watchdog. Well, without a hearing, apparently we want to be the lapdog.
That's Coral Springs Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz, who falls into that latter camp. He and others have written top House and Senate leadership calling for an independent probe.
Because there's enough here. How many other IG reports are out there that we don't know about that might have might place Floridians' lives at risk that are being kept secret? How many other pieces of legislation have departments filed to cover potentially corrupt behavior. So these are the reasons why we need a hearing. That's why I sent a letter to the Speaker.
Moskowitz is talking about a provision in a comprehensive bill filed during this past legislative session on behalf of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. It would have allowed for some concealed weapons license applications to be approved when background checks were not completed within 3 months. The only reason that provision did not move forward was because of the mass school shooting in Parkland. Still, as it relates to an investigation by the House, Moskowitz says he's not holding his breath.
Even though I can't reach Ms. Cleo, something tells me that we will not be having a hearing.
But between calls for resignations and investigations into the issue, some political scientists believe this could just be insider baseball. Retired University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus says this may not affect the opinions of average Florida voters.
What we're seeing is a public that doesn't know who they're going to vote for, that doesn't seem to be tuned in too much, not watching the news as much. It's one of the most difficult times to try and grab people's attention. And something like this issue, which has two sides to it, and it's fairly complex in terms of the actual details, probably to a lot of voters, it's not something that's resonating right now. That doesn't mean that it might closer to the election, but I think it's not grabbing a whole lot of casual voters' attention.
And as for Agriculture Commissioner and Republican gubernatorial hopeful Adam Putnam, he says if there is political fallout, he's prepared to deal with the consequences. For now, he says his immediate focus is to make sure this doesn't happen again. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kordner.
A Leon County Circuit judge has backed environmentalists who contend state lawmakers have failed to comply with a voter-approved constitutional amendment to buy and preserve sensitive lands. The initiative, known as Amendment 1 on the 2014 ballot, sends 33% of revenues from a tax on real estate documentary stamps to the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. In a bench ruling today, Circuit Judge Charles Dobson agreed with environmentalists that lawmakers, in his words, defied the 2014 initiative by improperly diverting portions of the money to such expenses as staffing rather than additional land purchases. The Florida Wildlife Federation and others called the decision a 100% victory. Legislators have directed at least $200 million a year of the money to the Everglades and $64 million per year to a reservoir in the Everglades agricultural area. Still to come on Capitol Report, the majority of Florida's Democratic candidates for governor are supporting free college tuition. And there are more than a few college professors who think that's a good deal for them as well.
As an adjunct professor, I do not make a living wage.
Meanwhile, one of the four Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls is focusing on kindergarten through 12th grade public schools.
And the charter schools and the vouchers that are going to allow students to take taxpayer dollars and go to private schools is a way for them to starve our public schools.
And what constitutes news and when should it be considered fake?
They're not practicing journalism. They're practicing pushing points of view on all of us.
Three of Florida's four Democratic candidates for governor are in support of free college tuition for students planning to enter Florida's workforce. Ryan Daly recently spoke with an adjunct professor who thinks the idea could revive the state's college system.
Free college tuition was one rally cry of the Bernie Sanders 2016 presidential campaign. It drew accusations from the Vermont senator's critics that he's a radical and ardent backing from his supporters. But in Florida, at a recent Democrat gubernatorial candidate forum, the idea had majority candidate support. And that begs the question, could the free tuition concept be going mainstream? Three of the four candidates vying for the governor's mansion want Florida's students to go to school without compiling debt. They just have to be willing to work in the state following graduation. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum wants to use his plan to remedy state shortages in fields like nursing and teaching.
What we proposed is a one-for-one. If you want to go into the teaching environment in this state and you've got an interest in doing so, but yet you are drowning under debt, we will pay your debt if you give us 4 years teaching in the state of Florida.
Orlando businessman Chris King wants free tuition to community college and trade schools. He calls his vision for a plan one of the biggest ideas that stands to change the state.
Florida leads the nation in locking people up. And we are spending hundreds of millions of dollars that I believe could be used towards public education and free community college and trade school.
King has an idea for how he would fund the program. His plan involves decreasing Florida's prison population by 50%. King says he would use what he figures would be the resulting $1 billion in savings. Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine says he would do everything in his power to usher in a system that puts less strain on students.
I believe if you're on Team Florida and you are a Floridian and you want to go to one of our colleges and your parents can't afford it, and you will commit to working in our state after you graduate, you should go to college debt-free.
At the candidate forum, former Congresswoman Gwen Graham did not go all in on free tuition, but pledged her support to the college system. The Dem candidate's calls for rethinking the system come at a time when adjunct faculty from colleges across the state are asking for reform. Some stakeholders say there are more part-time faculty than ever compared to those who are tenured. Christian Schlereth is an adjunct professor at three schools, Public Miami-Dade College and Private University of Miami and Barry University. He's part of an organization called Faculty Forward, advocating for professors who are in the same boat he is.
But when an older faculty member retires, and this is at all three institutions, that it is more cost effective to hire two or three part-time professors to take up that teaching load than it is to hire a full-time faculty member.
Schlereth received his PhD from University of Miami in 2014. He was surprised at how infertile Florida's ground is for professors. He says about 80% of professors at Miami-Dade College are there on a contingent or adjunct basis.
When I decided to go to graduate school for sociology and to see it all the way through to a doctoral program, I did not expect that I would be just a contingent part-time faculty member at three institutions.
Schlereth says it's all an effort to cut costs. He adds the system has been squeezed by less than adequate funding by the legislature.
Because then you don't have to pay for unemployment insurance for them. You don't have to pay for retirement plans. And you don't have to cover their health insurance.
And he's even picked up another job on the side.
So now to supplement my formerly supplemental income, I 10-bar part-time on the side.
So, the idea of free tuition would surely benefit Schlereth's students. But how will it benefit those teaching them?
If you have more students attending colleges and taking college courses, that means you're going to need more faculty members. And so that's how it would end up benefiting the faculty overall, as well as the adjunct faculty. We are paid per class as adjuncts. So that means that, for instance, Miami-Dade College has to offer more courses.
Schlereth says if he were to vote right now, Andrew Gillum would be his first choice for governor. The college climate has seen a push for the formation of unions at institutions like Hillsborough College, Broward College, and the University of South Florida. Angela Edwards-Luckett is an adjunct professor of world religions at St. Petersburg College's Tarpon Springs campus. She recently traveled to the Capitol with the Poor People's Campaign to make her case.
And I'm here to say today that we need to all join together and get this union pushing, because we deserve a living wage.
The Service Employees International Union, Faculty Forward's parent organization, says about 54,000 adjunct and other faculty on more than 60 campuses have unionized across the country. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
And As we just heard in Ryan Daly's piece, three out of the four Democrats running for governor are really enthused about free college tuition. The candidate who gave lip service to the idea but seems a bit less gung-ho is Gwen Graham. In fact, while she mentions colleges and universities in her stump speeches, that's just part of a bigger picture.
I want to be the public education governor, and I will be the public education governor from early education, pre-K, through our university system.
Graham, the former congressperson from North Florida's 2nd District, continually touts her support for Florida's traditional public schools, support now being reciprocated.
I was just endorsed by the Florida Education Association last week. Any educators in the room? Thank you. Thank you.
Graham tells the story of a young man who approached her when she was visiting his school. He said every school he'd attended had been classified as either a D or an F under the state system.
And I knew at that moment that I was running up for governor for that young man and for too many across the state of Florida who feel left behind by our education system.
Mainly by dismantling a system she claims unfairly pigeonholes not only schools, but students and teachers.
We're going to end the high-stakes standardized testing culture that has taken over our schools.
Graham wants to boost funding to Florida's traditional public schools.
We're going to make sure that we provide the resources for our schools so that every school district can give teachers the raises that they deserve. Our teachers need to be paid above the national average.
While vowing to roll back what she calls a horribly misguided policy.
What has been happening in the state of Florida is an all-out attack on our public schools, an attempt to privatize, and the charter schools and the vouchers that are going to allow students to take taxpayer dollars and go to private schools is a way for them to starve our public schools. And it's going to stop when I'm governor.
A not-so-surprising conviction for a person who was so racked by guilt the one time she skipped classes that she went to the school office and turned herself in. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, news is available at our fingertips, but what constitutes news, and when should it be designated as fake? CEO Ron Sachs with the Tallahassee-based Sachs Media Group is trying to stop the spread of misinformation, like keeping our own biases and emotions in check. He offers tips on how news consumers can discern what's truthful and what's disingenuous. He sat down with Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan.
Let's address the different kinds of fake news, because there's plenty of it out there, right?
Absolutely. Whether it's iPhones, iPads, or other devices, everybody in this new era has become a publisher and a producer, but it doesn't mean they have journalistically sound ways of posting or producing content. And so we are bombarded every day with messages from all sorts of sources. And people who are not good consumers of news could easily be duped by someone working an agenda to try and misrepresent the facts and the truth.
Let's talk about that, because there are plenty of outlets out there now that they have names that make them appear to be legitimate, but we know they are pushing a very slanted political agenda. How do you tell whether somebody's for real or not?
Let's first go to the ones that are for real. You could flip the channel between Fox News and CNN and hear two widely different views of the same world. And they're legitimate, supposedly. But you see reporters not interviewing, but prosecuting questions. And if they're sharing their opinion, they're not really reporting. They're opining. And it tends to influence people who are not straining out the difference between opinion and fact. And then absolutely, there are these new era media platforms that sound legitimate because they have the word news in them or fact or anything like that. They're not practicing journalism. They're practicing pushing points of view on all of us.
It's really all about now the headline. You have to get the clicks. A lot of outlets have really had to change what they do, and that involves kind of being a little bit sensational with their writing. Do you think this has harmed journalism's cause?
Yeah, I think, I went to journalism school here in Florida, and you know, at the heart of good journalism, just give me the facts. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. And if you give me those essential pieces of information, I can make my own conclusions and make my own deductions about what I believe. The problem is that we're in a selfie journalism era where we can record our own events and build an audience. And that's a good thing in some ways. The danger is when we put too much credibility into questionable sources.
So let's talk about how we can do our part to not believe the stuff that's being spread and not spread it.
The phrase fake news is used by everybody who wants to accuse anybody who's producing content that they don't agree with, no less than the President of the United States does it every single day. You almost hope that we wake up and realize this isn't really happening, but it is. So some really good-hearted, good-minded people created something called the News Literacy Project. And on that website is amazingly helpful, reliable content for everybody from school students all the way up to retirees to help you discern the difference between facts and opinion, truth and agenda.
With social media, we are easily able to spread fake news. We can be mean, and we can also very easily misconstrue what somebody says in a simple, benign comment, right? Instead of
That's
just
right.
saying it to them. You know, what do you think, good or bad, would be the impact of social media on this culture?
It is the most powerful new tool that's appeared in the communication landscape in decades. The good part of it is you could take an issue or a movement that would make the world a better place, and with social media tools, without having a large budget, build an audience, issue a call to action, get people engaged, involved in a way to actually make a change for the better. So I think the most recent example is the tragedy in Parkland at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Those students who survived and their families have been game changers. Using social media tools, we have never seen a movement emerge this quickly using a lot of those tools for the good. And the legislative session this year, they changed the entire focus of that legislative session. And it's now a national movement, and social media tools are at the heart of what has powered them forward. On the bad side, someone with bad intent could create a movement and misrepresent what it's about and engage an audience as well and lead a lot of people down a primrose path to disaster. We can see it being used to undermine a government, a business, a nonprofit. It is a tool that can be used to bully kids in school or bully people in the court of public opinion in business and in politics. So we owe it to ourselves and to our democracy to be better consumers of news and to question what we're hearing and to find the facts and the truth somewhere out there.
Ron Sachs, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having this topic on.
That was Sachs Media Group CEO Ron Sachs speaking with Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.